Hey, earners, what's up? Look, today's episode is brought to you by Acorns. Have you ever felt overwhelmed by the idea of investing? I know I have. It can seem so complicated, and sometimes you just don't know where to start. Many of us think we need a lot of money to get into investing, or that we simply don't have the time to manage it. Well, today I want to share something that's going to make your life a lot easier. That's right, Acorns. Acorns makes it easier to start automatically saving and investing for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can get started with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. And now, Acorns is putting their money into the future. Open an Acorns Later IRA and get up to a 3% match on new contributions. That's extra money for your retirement. Don't waste another second. Head over to acorns.com/EYL or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid client testimonial. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/EYL. Earners, what's up? Look, if creating content is more than just a passion project for you, it's time to make the passion profitable. With Kajabi, you can easily diversify your revenue, build your brand, and transform your audience into loyal customers. I know firsthand how challenging it could be to juggle content creation and business development, but Kajabi makes it easy to streamline everything in one place. As a creator, you are your brand, so your business should reflect exactly what you envision. With Kajabi, not only can you build your business your way, but you can also keep every cent of what you earn. It's an all-in-one platform that lets you focus on what matters most, your content and your audience. And let's face it, we all need a little help sometimes, especially when you're a one-person show. But you don't need to hire a full-time team. You just need Kajabi. Kajabi is a leading all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable, recurring revenue. Whether you're a coach, content creator, or educator, Kajabi makes it easy to transform your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, and more. The best part? Kajabi doesn't take a cut of your revenue. Everything you create is owned and controlled by you, so you keep 100% of what you earn. On top of that, Kajabi gives you robust analytics, easy payment options, email marketing tools, and customizable website templates. Everything you need to grow your business seamlessly. And here's the thing, you don't need a massive audience to make sustainable income. Thousands of creators are making 6 and 7 figures with Kajabi, even with less than 50,000 followers. So if you're navigating the challenges of generating revenue as a creator, Kajabi can be the game changer you need. Right now, Kajabi is offering an incredible deal, a free 30-day trial to help you kickstart your business. Just head over to kajabi.com/earn to get started. That's kajabi.com/earn. Join the creators and entrepreneurs who've made over $7 billion on their platforms and take control of your financial future with Kajabi today. kajabi.com/earn. Don't miss out on this opportunity to turn your passion into profit.
Earners, what's going on? Listen, EYLU is relaunching, revamping, retooling. That's right. We're creating a new educational experience that's more expansive. Shari, tell them what we got.
Yes, 2023. We got a lot in store, a lot planned for you guys.
So you know that EYLU already includes monthly financial planning calls with me, book club calls with Troy, real estate calls with MG the Mortgage Guy, access to the home buying blueprint, volume 1 and volume 2. Part of the revamp will include 27 local chapters from across the United States, live interactive teaching, hands-on, not just pre-recorded videos, plus 15 brand new curriculums.
The biggest just got bigger.
Head over to EYLUniversity.com. That's EYLUniversity.com. See you there.
All right, guys, welcome back. EYL.
We're back.
We are back home, and we have a special guest, Felicia Hatcher.
Yes.
Who is the CEO of Pharrell Williams Black Ambition Opportunity Incorporated.
I'm so ambitious.
Yes.
One of my favorite tracks.
Yes. They have the mission of helping thousands of entrepreneurs, but specifically 100 entrepreneurs raise more than $95 million. She has a strong marketing background, used to work at companies like Nintendo and Sony. And now she drives the team over at the Black Ambition Opportunity Inc. And she's also a very celebrated and accomplished speaker, author. She was part of the White House Champion of Change. She's been featured on Forbes, NBC, Bloomberg, to name a few. Mm-hmm. So happy to have her here. I know it's going to be a lot of information, a lot of gems that'll be shared. So thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank y'all for having me.
It's been too long. It has been too long. But we're here now.
We're here now.
First, let's start with Black Ambition.
Yeah.
Right? So what is it for people that have never heard of it before? How did it start and how do you get involved in it?
Sure. So Black Ambition was founded by Pharrell Williams 4 years ago to create uninterrupted opportunities to funding, community, contacts, care, and like wealth for Black, Hispanic, and HBCU entrepreneurs. And the best way I can describe Black Ambition is actually like the very first conversation that Pharrell and I had. And we were talking about the show Lovecraft Country.
And like, show.
Dope show.
One season, HBO, what happened?
And you can only describe it to people who've seen it. Like, if you've never seen it, it's very hard to describe to people. But there's a specific episode around episode 4 where there's two characters that are having a conversation. So one is Christina, which is this white woman with all these mystical powers. Mm-hmm. And then Ruby, who feels quite powerless. Like, she has all these things that she wants to do with her life, but she feels like she can't achieve any of it. She also feels like she just doesn't have any agency over her life or her body. And Christina turns to Ruby and she asks her this question, like, Ruby, who are you uninterrupted? And I had never heard that question before in my entire life. Work for some of the coolest tech companies in the world. Just never heard it. And I couldn't answer that question in that moment. And so, like, if nothing ever stood in your way of achieving success, what would life look like? If, like, at every intersection of your life, the light was never red, it was never yellow, it was only green, what would you build? Mm-hmm. And so for us with Black Ambition, it's not only how do we help them be better entrepreneurs, but, like, Black people are building companies, but they're constantly being interrupted. And so with Black Ambitions, like, how do we align all the resources? How do we align the resources of Pharrell to support these entrepreneurs so at every stage in which they need support, we can lessen the interruptions as much as, like, humanly possible is how we look at Black Ambition. And then when you think about ambition, it's like, okay, you can have the dreams, the hopes, the aspirations, but if you're constantly getting knocked down every single time, then you end up quitting or you don't get to scale at the rapid pace that you need to in order to have a return to any of your investors or your stakeholders. It's like, that's how we look at Black Ambition, is like, how do we make the pathway uninterrupted for them?
So I mean, it sounds like you two had aligned vision at that point. How did y'all meet, right? Because I mean, we all face things as Black entrepreneurs, Black people in business, so there are commonalities in vision, but where did y'all meet to even come, like, we need to do this together?
I co-founded an organization with my husband Derek called the Center for Black Innovation. We had built a conference called Black Tech Week that we end up selling to Lightship Capital a few years ago. And so I've been doing that work in building Miami's, like, Black tech ecosystem for almost 10 years. And about 3 years ago, Pharrell's chief of staff asked me to come, like, leave my organization that I founded and come run and kind of stand up Black Ambition for him. And so that's how we met. And the funny thing is the meeting that I had with the chief of staff wasn't the best meeting, like, professionally. And it was a lot of me saying, like, y'all should do all these things differently. And the next day I get a phone call. It was just like, we want you to come run it. And I was like, run what? It's like Black Ambition. Like, I think that you understand what needs to happen and how to grow and scale this. But it was definitely out of left field because the meeting didn't go that well.
Perspective is key. For them, they're probably like, she has all the ideas we need.
Or she's pushing back enough to, like, be able to go figure it out. But it was definitely, you know, at the time, something that was out of left field. But it was also very right next progression of how to support Black entrepreneurs specifically in the capital that they needed, which is the thing that I wasn't able to do in the 10 years of running Black Tech Week or the Center for Black Innovation.
So how specifically I have read in the beginning that, you know, the goal is to help 100 entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. right, raise more than $95 million, right? So what is specifically that, what does that mean? How exactly are you guys helping entrepreneurs? Is it like a contest that they have to enter? Are yeah. you matching them up with VCs? Like, how does this work?
Yeah, our initial goal from founding the organization was to support 1,500 entrepreneurs. And so we're pacing towards that as like our initial five-year goal. The majority of the work that we do is centered around a prize competition. And so that's how we source the entrepreneurs with partners, kind of raising the awareness for them to apply to the prize. And then we invest in five verticals. And so tech, healthcare, consumer goods and services, media and entertainment, and then AI is the new vertical for this year. And they enter a prize process. And we have about 200 application reviewers that help us take all the applications between 2 to 3 rounds of reviews. And then that takes us down to about 250 entrepreneurs every year. So it's a pretty extensive, heavy lift that we go through to find the best entrepreneurs in the United States. And then from those 250, we take them through a really dope 3-month cohort style mentorship program where we put them into pods and circles based off their strengths, their industries, and like what they need from a mentorship and community the most. That also secretly serves as like our vetting and evaluation of those entrepreneurs, like who's showing up to their pods, how are they contributing back to the other entrepreneurs. And then we take that from the 250 and then we invest in about 35 of those companies every single year. So we just celebrated investing in 101 entrepreneurs.
Congrats.
Which is amazing. It's faster than we kind of expected given the climate. And then those companies have gone on to raise over $95 million from the initial over $10 million that we've invested into those companies.
You have a unique vantage point, right? We mm-hmm. talked about working with Nintendo, working mm-hmm. with Sony. I know you've helped brands like Target and Disney and Google. What are some of the things, when we talk about disparities, especially inside that corporate world, it's tough to understand it because most people aren't in it. They never mm-hmm. get to see it. But talk about some of the vantage points that you saw that you can help entrepreneurs during this process.
Oof, there's a lot, right? So I think one of the biggest things is entrepreneurs cannot be intimidated by big corporations. Like the big corporations actually need them more than they, sometimes than you need them without realizing it, right? And so I always say that because there's a really interesting power dynamic that a lot of entrepreneurs that are just starting out feel like they can't contribute to the big boys. It takes the big boys a really long time to make decisions. And that's your secret sauce as a small company because you're very nimble. You can make a decision today. Right. And you can activate on that today. And so like that's always a value added to those major corporations that I think small entrepreneurs just aren't utilizing and playing up enough as like their core strength.
So as far as marketing, let's mm-hmm. have this conversation because I know that's your background. Yeah. Right? You worked for Nintendo and Sony. What are some core marketing lessons that you learned throughout your corporate journey and that you actually implemented while you were at those positions?
Ooh. I would say one of the biggest lessons, so I worked in experiential marketing for Nintendo, and so I launched the Wii Fit and the Wii Sports Resort. I think people often talk about like you got to know your target market, but like on a granular level. And so one of the things that I learned at Nintendo when we launched the Wii Fit board, I don't know if y'all remember that.
I do. That was powerful.
It was powerful, right? But like at that time, video games was only centered around like the pimple-faced kid playing like Nintendo in a dark, like whatever, that didn't do any exercise, didn't move their body. Yeah. That's what video games was centered around. And with working within Nintendo, what we settled on was like, that actually wasn't our core audience to launch this new product. What it was were alpha moms, right? And so like the best way we described alpha moms were moms that had a Blackberry in one hand, that's how old it was, and a kid in the other. But they were the first to make big buying decisions into their homes. And so this new board where it was requiring the family to be a part of it because that's how the games were kind of centered, but it was also kind of secretly for people to move their body and exercise. That wasn't the traditional profile of video games. And if it would have went in that way, then it wouldn't have been successful. And so it's like, how do you introduce video games to a whole new market? Well, you have to define who your new audience is. And I think sometimes when entrepreneurs first start, the audience that you first start with because you're just trying to get your feet off the ground is not the audience that you were still serving when you're trying to launch new product lines. I would say that was one of the best lessons that I learned is like, oh, alpha moms, right? They can influence bloggers. They have communities. They have massive disposable income. And so that was one of the things that was really helpful for me. And I took that and when we got laid off from Nintendo in 2008 during the economic downturn, I used that as kind of the core audience for the food company that I ran in Miami for 7 years. And so those were some of the things, is like literally changing the audience. And then also kind of supply and demand was this other really interesting thing that, like, once I read the book, The Psychology of Influence, I kind of understood what we were doing, because we were producing and marketing a product all across the United States. But like the scarcity tactic of it kind of, we were playing onto that because the product wasn't actually available until Christmas time came back around. Mm-hmm. But not just Christmas time, after Christmas time. So it forced parents to buy two products as opposed to one initial product that they had. And something that you see a lot happen with product companies at the end of the year.
That definitely was revolutionary. I remember mm-hmm. having it. It came with one controller and it came with two. Mm-hmm. But it became an initiative inside of physical education. I was a phys ed teacher mm-hmm. and it became, this is the new way you can gamify it. And so now we can use the Wii for the kids now exercise. So there's a tech component in there, because I'm thinking backgrounds in Florida. I'm thinking mm-hmm. there's a young girl in Florida with all these ideas. How did that it go from tech to then in the NBA, or what was the order, right? Because you worked with the Timberwolves. So did it go from Nintendo, now we're going to the NBA?
It was before. And so I worked with, was a front office marketing manager for the Minnesota Lynx and the Timberwolves. So the Timberwolves owned the Lynx, so the WNBA team. Mm-hmm. Ended up in Minnesota following my fiance, then husband, who got a job at Target as a financial analyst.
Okay.
A Florida girl in
Cold Minnesota.
Did not last long. Like the night it said negative 32 degree wind chill, I was like, I got to get the heck out of here. But I worked at a time where Kevin Garnett had just left. And so both teams were the worst teams in their respective leagues, the WNBA team and the NBA team. We couldn't sell tickets. We couldn't even give away tickets. You could literally buy a nosebleed and walk down to the floor and no one would bother you. That's how empty the seats were and the arena was. And so it was a really hard time, but it also kind of forced us in the front office to be more thinking much more intently about like the foundation that we needed to set to get back into our winning season. And the WNBA team, the Lynx, ended up winning that year that Simone Augustus. That was there.
And was that Sylvia Fowles or whatever is that?
This is like 15 years ago.
Oh, all right. So this is pre Maya Moore.
Yes.
Maya Moore comes. Okay. Gotcha.
I cannot remember who the lady, the marquee
I think it was
player
Simone.
At the time. No, it was.
She was a baller.
I think Simone wasn't there yet. It was somebody else, and her name's at the tip of my tongue. I will find it and I will tell you. But it was during that time working there. So it was really hard morale-wise in the front office, because we were just pushing all the responsibility on the people on the team to win. And I remember Chris Wright, who was the general manager at the time, kind of called us all into his office, like into like this big arena, all the staff. I thought we were all getting fired because the teams were doing that bad. And I just remember him constantly saying, like asking this question, are you 50 game ready? To us, like over and over and over again. I was like, what the hell does that actually mean? And what 50 game ready means is like 0.500, right? Like you've won just the same amount of games that you've lost, but you're still on track to making it to the playoffs. And if you make it to the playoffs, you get a clean slate, right? You have a really good chance of actually winning the championship. And what he was saying by that is like the dark days when things aren't going really well, right? None of the teams were winning. We in the front office were passing all the responsibility off to the, like if the team just starts winning, we're good. And that's not the case. Like the front office has to be good to handle when the team starts winning. So when the phone is ringing off the hook, when all your sponsors come back, when all your seats are filled, if we're not doing things right foundationally within the front office, we won't be able to handle either one of the teams having a winning season. And so like there's personal responsibility that I learned in that moment of like not passing it on to anything happening externally. It's like, what are we doing to prepare for that moment? And I think if you look at studies that showed like Oprah's book club and things like that, or products that were featured on her show, a lot of them did not succeed after that influx of traffic and phone calls, because when they were building, hoping and wishing for that moment, they weren't building a foundation strong enough to actually maintain it. And I think so many entrepreneurs are in that case. Like you want things to pop off. You want that big contract. You want that influx of funding to come in. And if you're not prepared foundationally, then it's not going to help you. It actually hurts you and can crumble you and like consume you whole.
So you talked about the scarcity model in the book. What was the book that you...
The Psychology of Influence by Robert Cialdini.
Okay. So I have a two-part question. Mm-hmm. But the first part is, can you really describe the... Because everybody knows the scarcity model. You just, you put less product out, right? And you drive up the demand. But I think there's some more... There's other elements that actually make that... It's not like you can just make 10 water bottles and say, I only have 10 water bottles. I'm going to charge $100 for them, right? Like... From your understanding and working inside of it, what made the scarcity model work when you guys were doing it?
Yeah, it was specifically when Nintendo or just in general?
Just in general, but Nintendo. Let's talk about that since you were in it.
Yeah, so we were in experiential marketing. We travel from city to city, putting up like these, literally bringing the video game to life. Like that was my job, right? And we were doing that, but the supply in the store, the product wasn't available. So like the hype gets built up of like, where can I find this thing? The value gets built up of like, where, like I will pay above what it's asking for to get this thing because I've experienced it. And so.
So you were promoting a product with no product available.
Correct.
The promotion was done with no even release date.
No, the product was out. You just couldn't find it.
Okay.
But we, like our teams, and this was one of many teams all across the United States, we were out every single day literally creating the like portions of the video game that you could walk into. That is very commonly known now. 10, 15 years ago, it was unheard of. This is also like social media was just becoming like a business utility. But it was like, how do I create my product and turn it into an experience? If people have an immersive experience as opposed to just being in the aisle of Best Buy and trying the product, it's a completely different, compelling moment that also makes you have a buying decision more expensive than you would usually have, right? Games were like maybe $40 to $50 at the time. The Wii Fit board, I believe, was about $300. So it was a different gap in the buying decision. What I'm telling you now is I didn't realize what was happening until I read the book, The Psychology of Influence. And so we were traveling all across the country, setting up these activations, and no one could buy it in the store. And so by the time Christmas comes around, it's like, hey fever, like everyone's trying to find this product, no matter where they'll find it, and they'll pay triple and double for the product. We see the same thing happening in the sneaker industry, right? Like people will pay way above the $50 or $100 because they cannot find it anywhere else. And so what I learned in the Psychology of Influence is the first time that they saw that happen was with the Elmo doll. Tickle Me Elmo. And they, the marketing industry and product industries were kind of conspiring to do this because they realized they could get parents to buy two products as opposed to one. So if I'm a kid and I want this Wii Fit or I want this Elmo doll the entire year, Christmas comes, as a parent, you have promised them that. You get to the store, you can't find it anywhere. So you know what? You buy them the next best thing. And then what those companies were doing is that right after Christmas, Elmos were flooded on the shelf. You could find it any and everywhere. And so as a parent, you also buy them the Elmo doll. And so they literally increased the lifetime value of that customer by not having the product that everybody wanted the most available when they needed it the most. You're going to buy something to just wrap and put under the shelves, and then you're going to buy that thing when it becomes available. And you've literally doubled the lifetime value of that customer. What I learned when I read that book is that's exactly what was happening with that product at that time that we were promoting it, is parents went and bought anything that they could possibly buy from an electronic standpoint for Christmas. Right after Christmas and right after the holidays, that board was flooded and any and everywhere. And I just didn't realize that. I only understood the experiential component of bringing people in so that they can experience it, and so that they would buy the product when it was available. So it was a weird time that we were in that I had that realization once I read that
book. So the whole idea is like to have it not in demand when you need it the most, and then an overflow of demand after peak season is over.
Yeah, so to not have it available when you need it the most.
When you need it the most.
Because you'll buy something else.
Yeah, I'm going to buy Mario Tennis.
Yeah, it's like if you have a significant other and she wants this very specific diamonds, you've promised the diamonds because you know how important it is. It's the only thing that she's asked for.
Yeah.
So you get to the jewelry store, the diamonds are nowhere to be found. You've gone to numerous stores, you cannot find it. You're not going back home without something. Yeah. That's done by design and intention. So you're going to buy that thing. And now when that thing becomes available that she really wanted, well, that want doesn't go away just because you bought her a watch.
You gotta buy it again.
Yeah. You buy the thing again.
The sneaker thing is perfect.
Yeah.
It's like, every Christmas, Jordan's going to release a 11, right? If the kid doesn't get the 11, they'll probably buy the kid a pair of KDs.
Yeah.
Nike sees that. Oh, restock. Mm-hmm. And now everybody gets to have the shoe, and now you have the customer literally more than one purchase.
Yeah. And I think one of the things about reading that book and understanding is at first it pisses you off. You're like, man, I fell for all these tricks.
Yeah, as you were saying, and I'm like, I think I fell for this a few times.
But then I think as an entrepreneur, you can use that and turn that around, right? And so the difference between the two is, I think on the advertising industry, there's a little bit of manipulation. And from an entrepreneurship standpoint, you can use that in your favor of thinking like, well, how do I market a product to this person where they, if I don't have it available, then there's something else that's equally or close to what they want, but then still keep them around long enough that they also buy the thing that they want. There's one way to look at it, right? The other way to look at it is intention. Is your intention to manipulate people into buying two things, or is your intention to increase the lifetime value of the customer in a meaningful way that increases like their affinity to who you are and what you're building? I think there's another way to look at that, right? And then when I think of like Black businesses, and I see this happen in the food business more than anything, you'll go to a restaurant, they don't have like 9 things on the menu, right? And you're like, man, I'm never gonna come to this restaurant again. And then I've seen other menus in other companies who will say, well, first come, first serve, right? Like if we run out, we run out. And you start getting to that early because they've set a different kind of expectation around the scarcity and limited availability. It's how you communicate it. Mm. In one instance, I see Black businesses being demonized for that. They ain't never got what they say they're going to have. They never open when they say they're supposed to open. They close in early. And then I've seen it manage, the expectation managed around that in other... South by Southwest, the barbecue place there is a prime example. You know that if you don't get there at 6 o'clock in the morning, you may not get that barbecue because once they run out. You're not saying like, man, they ain't this, they don't have anything together. You know what? You wake up the next morning at 6 o'clock because you really want that barbecue. Everyone's spoken so highly about it. And you know that it's now a very kind of sacred experience that you have that you wouldn't have anywhere else because you get to try something that other people may not try because they've missed a line. It's about how we manage expectations in business and then how we communicate the value of what we're doing. In one end, you're never going to go back there because they'll never have anything together. Mm-hmm. There's literally no difference. The supply is gone. You get there first. One instance is coveted, and in the other instance is demonized. And that's not fair, but it's a business lesson that people have to learn.
You got a second part? Because it's interesting because I'm thinking about the strategy. I feel like it's brilliant, but it does also determine on what stage of business you're at, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're a new entrepreneur, you have to first build a client base, you have to build a trust, and you have to set those expectations. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to those foundational pieces. I know you were talking about foundation. So as an entrepreneur, you said sometimes we're not ready. And this is true. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of people. We've seen it happen here. People come on the show. They got that push. Mm-hmm. And then it's like they weren't ready for the push.
Yeah. So, I know what that feels like. I was there.
What are those foundational pieces that you would say that entrepreneurs should have in the event that what you're wishing for actually comes to fruition?
Yeah, I think something that you said in the beginning of that can be your business model in the beginning too, right? You see like a lot of businesses that have customized products or you have to be tailored. And we were talking about Ghana. My husband got like 10 outfits in Ghana and he had to be tailored and measured for it. It wasn't anything that he could buy off the shelf. But I've also seen entrepreneurs where they have very limited capital, very limited product supply. And then they're constantly sold out on their website without communicating that, hey, this is a one of a kind piece. And it's going to take 6 to 8 weeks to be able to get it. And as because of that, there's a premium price that's associated with that in order to accompany. And like that is the business model. I've also seen like I've gotten people to come to my house to cut my hair or like do my nails, and they charge bottom basement pricing and they're not charging like a travel fee. Well, that's not. And they feel like they're less than because they don't have a shop. I was like, you were providing a concierge service. What are you talking about? Like, if you don't add significant tax on that, but that's a misalignment with who they're serving. Mm-hmm. If you understand that you're serving people that value their time and constantly trying to buy back their time, they will pay a premium to not go sit in a barbershop or make an appointment, but still sit there for 2 hours. And so if you understand who your true customer is around that, there is no scarcity issue. And there's a different way that you can look at the business and a different way that you can promote the business that increases the value of it significantly. If you can come to my house and cut my hair, I will pay you double or triple because I don't have time to sit in the barbershop. it is not less than of your business. And I think that's the thing that even in the application process with Black Ambition, we see over and over again is like really amazing ideas, really amazing traction. They have no idea how to communicate the value high enough that that I can see a return on the investment, or any other investor or partner can see a return on that. And then oftentimes we don't understand why we're not seeing the money. And there's other nuances as part of that. And then you see white businesses being able to accelerate in the exact same industry. Sometimes what I see in the difference is there's an overinflation of the value on one end, and there's an underinflation of the value on the other end. There's other parts to that. There's racism.
Yes.
That's also something that we see time and time again in our applications.
So what are some other things, or like another thing that you picked up from that book?
FOMO. It was another one. So fear of missing out and how to like kind of enact that. One of the other things that I thought, and I cannot remember the name of the principal, but what is it called? It'll come to me. But essentially, it gave this example of this bakery that like this person would drive by all the time, and they saw the bakery, but they didn't really pay any attention to it. And then the one day that they saw a line outside the door is the day that they stopped. And it was literally because someone else validated that decision for them. Right. And oftentimes we can call that like following. I'm forgetting what the principle is, and it's killing me that I'm forgetting. But like there's that in and within itself is something that you can duplicate as a business principle.
Well, that's why like clubs intentionally have lines.
Right.
Like you go in a club sometimes and
it's
like,
empty.
There's enough room to get people in. But it's like if nobody's waiting online, it doesn't look like it's lit. Like
right.
You
don't,
but then if somebody's waiting online now, you'll pay $3,000 for bottle service because mm-hmm. the anticipation on what's inside based off of people trying to get in that's not able to get in makes it more appealing than if they just let everybody in.
Yeah. And you want, as human nature, we make decisions oftentimes not based off of ourselves, but the validation of someone else. You see that in the investment space and corporate partnership space especially, right? I don't want to be first money in. If anybody else comes in with money, then I will definitely come in, but I need to kind of de-risk my decision, right? The club is no different. I don't want to go into something that's not popping. It's empty inside, mm-hmm. but the line is so long that it makes me feel like the vibe is already created. I don't have to be the one to come in and create the vibe. And that's how we make decisions as humans. That's how we're influenced by other people. Like that's how I bought the first iPhone, right? Like that line, I was just like, it must be, because what we say is like, there is not never going to be like, oh, it must be empty in there. There must be something unique and special that I need to be a part of if this line is that long. Whether the thing tastes good or is good or not, the line makes the decision for you. And so many of us do buying decisions specifically because we see those things happen.
I feel like Chipotle did a masterful job with that.
Yeah.
It was like, no matter what time you went, it was going to be a line.
Chipotle, Apple with the iPhone, yeah. Sneakers. You can see, and these things are sometimes very warranted because the product is good, but a lot of times, like nightclubs, it's manufactured for the very specific reason that they know it's going to enact one of the principles of the psychology of influence of how we make decisions.
Yeah, you brought up the criteria when you're looking at the applications. We talk about, especially our community, having businesses that are scalable. Talk mm-hmm. about the importance of that, right? Because, I mean, you said you get thousands of applications, I'm sure, yeah. There's criteria that they have to meet. How much of it is this business scalable on your criteria?
Yeah, like, that's high that we look at, right? I think especially in like our tech vertical as well as our CPG vertical, you cannot be a product of one. Like, who are you selling it to? And then your vision has to be big enough that we as investors can see where we can go along with you in the journey and how big you're thinking about it. I think now, kind of given the landscape, if you're not thinking, especially as a company or a product that serves people of color, like not looking at like the global landscape as your marketplace, then you're really short-sighted about what you're building and where it can go. The other part is people need their money back, right? Like you want to make sure that you can ensure some sort of return And if those things aren't communicated, then you miss the opportunity of people being able to see how they can go along with you in the journey. And so scalability is important. I think what scalability means to you is a bigger question, because I think as entrepreneurs, what you also see is people just start asking you that question all the time. Well, how are you going to scale this? How are you going to scale this? Your intention may just to dig deeper into the market that you're in, right? Or the neighborhood or the region that you're in. It doesn't always have to be scaling nationally or internationally, but you have to be able to communicate how you can go deeper within the niche that you're in. And I think one thing, and I can't remember who I heard this from, but like, hey, if you solve one problem for someone, you end up creating 10 more problems for them, which is amazing and masterful to think about, right? And I think sometimes people don't communicate how they can go deeper and increase the lifetime value of the existing customer base, the region, the city, the state, the country that they're in with their product. And so what do I mean by that? If you help people write books, okay, now that the book is done, they need publishing, they need printing, they need PR, they need graphics done, they need their author photo done, they need at least 10 other things, 10 other problems that you created.
Earners, what's up? Y'all know the adage, buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/earn. That's fundrise.com/earn. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hi, I'm Sean Nelson, founder and CEO of Lovesac and host of the Let Me Save You 25 Years podcast. Want to avoid common pitfalls and get straight to the insights that drive success? Join me and recognize names like John Mackey of Whole Foods and Joe DeSena of Spartan as we unpack the hard-earned lessons from their journeys. Ready to streamline your path to success? Listen to Let Me Save You 25 Years on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Let Me Save You 25 Years with Sean Nelson. Listen now.
That within itself can make you extremely wealthy if you think about it. So when we talk about getting niche down or getting scaling, sometimes it's not this. It's literally going from here, here, or here, here with that customer base and being able to communicate that.
So as far as... another marketing question. Mm-hmm. What's a good lead? Because I study like boxing, right? And I noticed that like boxers, they announce the fight and then they go to training camp for about 5 weeks and then it's quiet. That training camp period is quiet.
Yeah.
And then like 2 weeks before the fight, that's when it's an onslaught of just marketing. They don't market the whole entire 6 weeks, right? So from your perspective, what is a good time to actually market leading up to like a drop date or a release date or an event, as opposed to starting too early and then you just kind of wasting time? Because people usually don't buy until there's a sense of urgency, like leading up to the actual date.
Ooh. So you hit on something really interesting, because it's also the thing that I hear the most of, like, I got to build in silence. And I think that's some of the worst business advice that people tout. There's a lot of bad, crazy things that people say. It's all also like, I got to get the coins in the bag. Like, do you really want coins? What kind of bag do you want? Like, what? Like, you got to be very specific. And so why I hate when people say you got to build in silence is because most times people have no idea what you're doing. And you think that people around you understand what you're doing and what they're building and how they can help you, and they do not. Not unless you communicate it. And so I think the boxing part is a really good example. But I think the way movies are put out, or how they used to be put out, is a better, it's like a better example, if I can explain that, right? And so when a movie first comes out, you know, most entrepreneurs, they just pop open and they expect the arena to be full. Are filled. It does not happen. You do not build it and they will come. You have to create the village and the community. And so when movies are created, maybe 3, 4, 5 years before, you have a few of the key artists or the few of the key actors talking about, I'm working on this movie. They may do some light interviews. They may do some drops. You may see a little bit of content that they're on the studio, but they've told you that they are in the process of building something.
How many, what's the time frame? You said 3 or 5 months?
I've usually seen it like 2 to 3 years out.
Yeah. 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, because it takes a year plus sometimes years to be able to do a movie. Yeah. But usually those marquee top artists, or I keep saying artists, but like actors, they drop that they're working on a movie. They may even drop the title, but they drop something, right? Yeah. And then as it progresses, you start to see more and more things literally about the process. There's nothing wrong with documenting your process to getting to that point. And then as I would say, like maybe a year out is when you start to see the commercials. Mm-hmm. You start to see the press junkets. Mm-hmm. You start to see the trailers come out.
Behind the scenes footage.
The behind the scenes footage, yeah. Right? And then months, the 3 months leading up to it, that's when you see the onslaught of things. So that on Friday night, when the movie hits, there is actually people to buy the tickets. And I think entrepreneurs look at, and not all entrepreneurs, but I think entrepreneurs that are scared, rightfully so, I get it. Mm-hmm. But if you want to sell a product and you want people to support you, you got to let them know and be a part of the journey of getting there. That's part of the storytelling. That is the magic that builds the affinity for people wanting to actually purchase or be a part of the process. People want to be a part of your winning season and your process. And if you never tell them what you're working on because you're building in the dark, which is very bad information, there's nobody there. And then what happens is you get very discouraged because there's no one there to support you. You then very ill blame your friends and family. Like, why are they not buying a product? They're not your customer. My husband and I ran a gourmet popsicle manufacturing company, like with clients like PayPal, Google, Target, like for 7 years. I never went to my parents and like, why y'all not buying popsicles? Why? Because my parents are Black and they like butter pecan ice cream. They're not buying popsicles. They never bought a popsicle, but they supported me in other ways. But I also knew they were not my customer base. Wealthy white women were our customer base because they could buy a $30 box of popsicles, or they can buy a $40 box of alcohol popsicles. Like, that was our customer base, right? Like, and we had to understand that, and it was hard for us to get to that point. But I like just stress people in that process of, do not build in the dark. You don't have to give all your IP away, but you got to make sure people understand the journey that you're on, and then the value that you're bringing and what problems that you're solving. And if you wait until you bought all this inventory to even test any of that, then you've already started with a bad foundation.
And you talked about don't build in the dark, right? So mm-hmm. a part of that to kind of alleviate that would be to get mentorship.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to talk about what Black Ambition is doing and its intentionality around having mentorship for these entrepreneurs.
Mentorship, but like the right type of mentorship, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I know people say this quote all the time, Black people are underfunded but over mentored, and I truly believe that. Where we're different with Black Ambition, and this mostly comes from like my past entrepreneurial experiences, I had some really great mentors and I had a lot of BS mentors that would just look at my deck and say, okay, change this, change that. But like, if I needed the buyer for Whole Foods and you had that person in like as a contact, as a college buddy, and you would look at what I'm building, understand the value of it, but you would never make that phone call for me, well, you're doing me more of a disservice. And that's what I've seen happen for the years that we were building Black Tech Week. That's what I've seen happen in the beginning years of Black Ambition, is like you had a lot of people that wanted to mentor Black people to get a pat on the back. But they weren't actually valuable in opening up their Rolodex and opening up like their contacts and putting you on. And so we need more mentors that put you on. And so that thought process is what we've ingrained into Black Ambition. Like, we have really amazing mentors that have invested in their entrepreneurs. have opened up the doors to HSN, to Target, to Walmart, to major retailers because of that very specific intention. If you are not going to call on behalf of our entrepreneurs, do not come to our program. And our entrepreneurs, people have gotten very comfortable wasting the time of Black entrepreneurs, like wasting the time. And time is the only commodity that you do not get back. And so when we're talking about closing the wealth gap, well, wealth has a need for speed. And if we don't fully understand that as a big utility for Black entrepreneurs, then get out of the way. Do not bother them. Give them what they need and then get out the way so that they can build their companies because they're equipped to it. They just are oftentimes blocked from the resources that are necessary. And so in the 3 months of the cohort for Black Ambition, we have about 50 mentors throughout the pods that we create for the 250 companies that do exactly just that. They're supporting them with the knowledge, the resources that they need, but then they're also opening up doors for those entrepreneurs because they have really good companies. And to me, that's the biggest kind of show of belief in those companies is if you're leveraging your reputation and your relationships in support of them.
Yeah, you said entrepreneurs, and it made me think, because I know Shai's thinking from the marketing standpoint, mm-hmm. With Jay and Pharrell putting the song out, mm-hmm. That was part of the rollout for Black Ambition. Is this part of the marketing?
It was the impetus for that. Yeah, okay. The song. Virgil designed the logo for Black Ambition, mm-hmm. And it was Pharrell has a long standing career in this, right? As an entrepreneur, as a creative, as a musician, right? Mm-hmm. Among so many things, and owns a ton of companies in a lot of different verticals. And so Black Ambition is literally him. Like I say that to him all the time. Mm-hmm. And I say that to people like looking at where he came from Virginia and figuring that out and like getting to this point where he's now building legacy for himself and his family. And then that legacy is through the 101 entrepreneurs that we've invested in.
Yeah, it was perfect timing. When that song came out, we in our second year.
Yeah.
It was like, it sounds like he's championing what we're doing.
Black man, yeah, all of that, yeah.
Perfect.
So how did you connect with him?
His chief of staff asked me to come lead Black Ambition. And that was my first time meeting him and chatting through like what Black Ambition could be and what we can grow it into. The need and the importance of it. And then more than anything, how to really kind of extract the resources and the access and the people that are around him to support the entrepreneurs. And so that was literally one of our first conversations.
So how hands-on, obviously everybody knows he lives in Paris and mm-hmm. he's running Louis Vuitton. So I'm sure he got his hands full.
Yeah.
How hands-on is he? And like, how often do you communicate with him?
I talk to him quite a bit because he's my boss. But he's really hands-on as much as he can be with Black Ambition, right? And so, and a lot of that comes from like his ideas and his vision around it, and then his resources and his people more than anything. You know, when you talk about when I was talking about mentors being able to kind of conflate the time that's needed for entrepreneurs, one of my first asks of him, and I take all the entrepreneurs' asks that they have and present it to him and his team for them to really kind of find the contacts for the entrepreneurs. But I remember one of the companies, Femly, which is a feminine hygiene company, one of the 2021 prize winners, who had been knocking on the door for Marriott for about 2 years, could not get through. And having that conversation, I'm like, hey, she's trying to get into Marriott. He's like, well, I know one of the owners of Marriott. And like within two phone calls, it helped her get into, I think, her first one or two locations in Marriott. That's what Black entrepreneurs need. Mm-hmm. That's what we need, right? And so now she gets 2 years of her time back. Unfortunately, she had to spend 2 years to get to that point. But I think that's the magic of having really good mentors that can just pick. Like these are, when you're working with high net worth individuals, right? And you're trying to get entrepreneurs to get more comfortable to their proximity to power and to wealth, it's introductions. And it's phone calls. And that is always the thing that in that moment excited me, how quickly it can happen. But it also further discouraged me because how long it takes and how difficult sometimes people make it seem like you got the contact. If you really believe in Black entrepreneurs, why won't you pick up the phone? Because if you needed, and I ask people that, like if you needed to raise, $5 million really quick for your business, who are the top five people that you're calling? That's my question. Who are the five people that you're going to call? And they tell me. I was like, great. I need you to call those five people for our entrepreneurs. Because if you can do it for yourself or one of your buddies, but you keep telling me you believe in our entrepreneurs, call those five people for them. And if they can't do it, they don't need to be involved in anything that you have going on. And that's always my test and in my conversation. And sometimes they look at me crazy. Sometimes they stutter. And then for the most part, they make those introductions. I've had some instances where they won't. But then you know what? You've told me exactly who you are. Because if you believe and you know you can do it for yourself, then do it for these entrepreneurs, right? And so when we talk about like Pharrell's involvement, a lot of it has been putting our entrepreneurs on. And then he spends, we do 2 office hours with the entrepreneurs once we invest in them with him. And then a lot of it is just like his amazing partners, right? And so we were in New York maybe about a month ago now, where LVMH is a funder of Black Ambition's work. And we created a learning lab. We did it with Chanel when they were partners, and now we've done it with LV. And we bring all of our entrepreneurs that we invest in into 2 days into their headquarters. And then a day into their headquarters and then a day into their distribution center. No one gets to go to the distribution center. You get to go to it because you're a Black Ambition entrepreneur. And so they get to ask all the questions about the supply chain and logistics from literally the top people that are doing it, from one of the top luxury brands in the world. They build out strategic plans for them. They answer any questions. The president of the US comes and speaks with the entrepreneurs and like mentors them. So there's that high level of corporate mentorship that happens literally because Pharrell is a part of LVMH and they believe in the entrepreneurship.
Joe Biden, the president, you said the president of the United States?
No, the president of Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, I'm gonna say.
That would be cool too. But we got the president of Louis Vuitton.
I don't know if you know anything about the luxury sales business. No, he knows something about another business. You said family is one of the success. I'm sure there are. What are some of the other success stories from companies and entrepreneurs that you've invested in?
Yeah, it's like talking about what's your favorite baby, right? There's 101. So we do a $1 million investment each year. And then the rest of the investments range between 25K to 250K. And we do about 30 to 35 of those each year. Our first year prize winner, Livegistics, is a construction like SaaS company out of Detroit that has done phenomenally well. In the first year from the investment of Black Ambition, they went on to raise an additional $6 million. They went from 4 employees to 34 employees in the span of a year. They're not leaving Detroit, and I love that, right? So what they've been able to do with waste management and the contracts that they've gotten across the United States has been absolutely, absolutely amazing. And I remember when the first year of the prize, it was on Zoom because it was in the height of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And myself and Pharrell popped up on Zoom to tell them that they won the $1 million. And everyone is in tears. And then after I get off the phone, Pharrell calls me. And I'm like, oh, Lord, what he calling me about? And he calls and he was just like, that's the blueprint. And he was just like, when I was dreaming about what Black Ambition was going to become, I couldn't see who the entrepreneurs were going to be. I just knew that I was building something for them. And he was just like, they are the blueprint. Them, Khadijah, which was our Dose of Beauty, which creates hyperallergenic braiding hair, was our HBCU top prize winner for that year. So Livegistics and then Khadijah Dosa. Those two companies, that's who we got off the phone and he was just like, that's the blueprint. That's who I was dreaming about. And so they have been the model ever since of how we look for companies. The second year of the prize, Pound Cake, which is a lipstick company that has like this proprietary technology. I know y'all wouldn't necessarily know, but like you can buy lipstick in the store and no matter whatever your skin shade is, it's going to be a different color for whoever wears it. Mm-hmm. So they created a technology that it's the exact same color no matter who puts it on from a cultural skin tone standpoint. They were listed as one of Time 100's top inventions of the year that they won the Black Ambition Prize. They just rolled out into 800 Ulta locations.
Oh, wow.
Last year's $2023 million prize winner is Antoinette Banks with a company called Expert IEP. She founded the company because her daughter had autism and was given this prognosis that she'll never be able to like matriculate through K-12 with any level of success. And like Black mothers, she said, watch me. and her daughter, I think, just graduated either high school or just graduated college. And so she created a software that helps families and parents better navigate the individual learning plans that are created with school districts so that parents have much more power on how their children are being educated and much more accountability from the schools. And so those were our top three prize winners. I can go on and on. Like, there's one of our companies that just rolled out into 4 airport locations. You have a prosthetic company out of Atlanta, like some really, really phenomenal companies. You have Cosmology that's just rolled out into Target and HSN. The companies are doing phenomenally well.
So you guys invest in the companies. Mm-hmm. You take equity, obviously.
Yeah.
How much is it, the same equity, or is it depends on how much?
It's the same across the board.
What is it?
We do it through a safe agreement. It's an 80% discount that we do. So it's a very small amount that comes back into Black Ambition so that we can fund more entrepreneurs.
Okay. And then you help them raise more money
mm-hmm.
from a network of rich people that you are connected with.
Yeah.
Right?
Rich people and corporations. Yeah.
And you also help them with mentorship.
Yes.
You would have them, like, if somebody's in beauty care, you would have a mentor in the beauty care industry.
Correct. Right? Correct.
And then that person would get equity in the company too?
No. Oh, well, any follow-on funding is something that's done separately. It's just what we do with Black Ambition and then connecting them to the mentors and the support that they need.
So the business model, how do you guys make money from? Because I guess the plan is for these companies to make money, exits, and then you'll get paid later on. But in the meantime, how is it
funded?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Black Ambition is a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit. Most of our funding comes from foundations and major corporations that are our partners that support the organization and allow us to do our programming and then also allow us to be able to invest and inject capital into those companies.
LVMH, I'm assuming, is a major contributor.
They're a major partner. Adidas is a major partner of ours as well. Lennar Foundation is a fantastic partner of ours. Comcast NBC Universal is a new partner of Black Ambition too.
And okay,
this is before he started working at Louis Vuitton, or after he started this company?
LV?
No, this your company.
Uh-huh.
Did he start this before Louis Vuitton or after?
Yeah, so Black Ambition is 4 years old.
Okay.
And he's been on with LVMH as a men's creative director for maybe about a year and a half now.
So I'm assuming he probably put it in the contract that Louis Vuitton has to kind of help support this, right?
It's never really in like his contract as like an artist or the work that he does, but these are natural partnerships that make sense, right? And so I think when you think about artists, they can do a lot of different things other than contribute back into their community. And I think when you think about musicians or rappers, essentially, they usually get that bad rap, them and athletes, that they don't contribute back to their community. So I think the unique way in which he has done it in forming Black Ambition that allows us to fund these entrepreneurs is unique within itself, but it's something that we really want other people to copy. Like, copy our framework, copy our process, because we need as many entrepreneurs supported as possible.
Well, I think one of the things that I don't think people even know that it's happening.
Mm.
So part of it, I think, is actually getting the word out. That's why I'm glad you're here. But I haven't heard him speak about it. So
he does quite a bit. I force him to.
Well, I think in outlets that we listen to.
Okay. Okay.
That's important for our community.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's because it's good. Like, representation is good.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it's good to actually copy. Right.
Yeah.
But you can't copy if you're not actually aware of what's actually currently happening.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, thank y'all for this outlet
to be able to
do so, because I think, one, the work is what we've been able to do for the past 4 years is important. The road ahead is equally important. And I think a lot of times when people build programs or institutions like this, they try and hold on to all the resources, the failures as well as the success. And we're very open about like what hasn't worked for us, so other people can not go down that journey when they're building programs to support entrepreneurs. And then we've been equally talking about like the road ahead and then the successes that we've had, right? But like what we have learned in the process of that is super important. I think the one thing that I didn't mention that to me is one of the most important parts of the program is we approach it from a holistic standpoint. And so we have therapists on staff that support our entrepreneurs through a program called Evoke. So the entrepreneurs get group wellness and mental health support. They also get a bucket of one-on-one support, because my heart goes out to any entrepreneur that bet the house, cash in on their 401k right before the pandemic for literally every worst case scenario that stopped them before to happen when they started a business. And that was the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so people are not okay. And when you talk about entrepreneurship and the ebb and flow of it, some days it's really good, some days it's really bad. People are burnt out. And in my entrepreneurial journey, I burnt out twice. I do not wish burnout on anyone. And so when you're talking about that aspect of entrepreneurship, and then the fact that, again, when I go back to the proximity of wealth and power that many of our entrepreneurs are having for the very first time, that power dynamic of constantly going in front of people that don't look like you, asking them for corporate opportunities, asking them for contracts, asking them for money, it wanes on you. People always talk about, you got to get to 100 no's for your yes. The second no is hard as hell. The fifth no, you don't want to get out of bed, but we need them to be whole as entrepreneurs, and that we need them to be good stewards of the resources that we provide at Black Ambition. And then when they raise capital, they're stepping into new levels of leadership for the very first time. They're the first in their family to do these things for the first time. And a lot of them do not have the tools mentally to be able to sustain their business to even get to a point of scalability. Yeah. And so having therapists on staff is something that is a kind of a really big component and vertical of Black Ambition. And it aligns back to Pharrell, who is a very spiritual and holistic person that we've incorporated into our programming for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, you said there are some of the things that have not worked. And obviously business and entrepreneurship is a learning process in itself. Yeah. So at this level, at this point, are there things that you're learning from entrepreneurs? And, mm-hmm. and what are some of the things that didn't work for you guys? Oof.
How long are we going to be here?
We got time.
Yeah, there's a lot that we learn from them. You know, I think the programming around our HBCU entrepreneurs, we had to revamp because it wasn't aligned with where those entrepreneurs are at the very early stage. When we first started Black Ambition, we had like an ideation track. So you could just apply for the prize with just an idea. Well, you were applying for the prize with just an idea with entrepreneurs that were doing revenue upward of $1 million+. That's a misalignment for investors on the back end of once we invest in them, if we're pulling them all together to have a meeting. And we also want to make sure that we're not setting those entrepreneurs that are super, super early up for failure. And so that's the learning that we had. So we took out the ideation track from the prize. It was painful to take it out, but we had to in order to, one, hold on to the integrity of what we built, and then make sure that those entrepreneurs, the corporate, the investor introductions that we were making for them, that they were ready and ripe for those opportunities. And so that required us to just change how we supported HBCU entrepreneurs and those in the ideation stage. And so we launched an HBCU tour. We launched an HBCU pre-accelerator to help those entrepreneurs still get them some capital. Those are grants. Those aren't investments. But it allowed them to just kind of get a little bit more hands-on support that they needed in order to get them ready for the next stage. That was one of the biggest learnings that we had. The time to complete the application is in and with itself is something that we had to change too. And I think there's a lot of... After the murder of George Floyd, there were an onslaught of programs that were built, right? Onslaught of programs. And every single one of them was requiring an application that took you 2 days. Well, that's not actually fair to the entrepreneurs because they need to build their companies. And so if there's 10 programs that I'm trying to apply for and each one of those are taking me 22 or 23 days, but they're all asking for the same question, how can we lessen that load for them and just get the exact information that we need to create the opportunity for them, but then also stop wasting their time? And so like those are some programmatic things that we had to change. And then what I mentioned to you about the mentors is reevaluating all the mentors that were coming into our program and then being able to share that with other organizations. And like these are better metrics that are better supported for Black entrepreneurs with the mentors that they need that are not going to waste their time. And I would say like the last thing, which is still like a very present thing, is like there was a McKinsey study that came out, I think, last year about like the sheer amount of money that was allocated, well, verbally committed to Black businesses after the murder of George Floyd, well, that number's $340 billion. Not million. $340 billion was verbally allocated from corporations to support Black businesses, infrastructure, transportation, housing. And then there was another study that came out that said only 1% of that has actually been allocated. That's a lot of money that's floating out that is owed to us. And so advocating because of who our founder is and the voice that we have is also better advocating for the distribution and the allocation of that money. Because imagine if we got the $340 billion distributed across our businesses and our communities, we would be pretty good. So it's literally just like, how do we ask and how do not only ask, but like demand and hold accountable for the money that was already verbally committed to us. And so you've seen a lot of programs similar to ours shutter because they've been secretly rolling back the money by saying, well, we put this program out there, but nobody applied. Mm-hmm. So we try so we can reallocate the money. Right. Or we fired all our D&I people. So there's no internal accountability. So we can roll this money back or we can just redistribute it. And or the last thing, what you've seen with the law, with all the recent lawsuits is, hey, if we change policy, now we never have to allocate this money. And so everything that you've seen in the past 4 years as it relates to programs similar to ours are unfortunately being rolled back aggressively. And so how do we become better mouthpieces and advocates for the money that was literally committed to us is also the change that we had to make.
So how can people apply?
BlackAmbitionPrize.com is where they go to fill out and complete their application.
And this is I know. Is it international yet, or are we scaling to that point?
So we started international expansion last year.
Okay.
We did Ghana during Afrofuture.
We
partnered with the Aspen Institute for going to Cartagena, where we invested in some Afro female Colombian entrepreneurs. We did Brazil a few weeks ago in partnership with Aspen Festival of Diaspora as well. And we invested in 7 female Brazilian entrepreneurs, and all roads now lead to the Olympics. And so we'll launch a prize competition similar in scope and check size in the US. We'll do that in Paris as a part of the Olympics. So we're gonna bring some US-based entrepreneurs to the Olympics, be able to partner them with some of our partners and create some opportunities for them there. And then we're launching a prize competition for diverse entrepreneurs during the Olympics. I think entrepreneurs compete on the global stage just like athletes do, right? They train just like athletes do. They have to have the mindset just like athletes. And more than anything, they carry their culture on their back just like athletes. And so why can't entrepreneurs be on the podium during the Olympics too? Is kind of like our present, like our thought process around that.
Well, appreciate you for coming. Thank you. How can people follow? What's the social media handles and everything?
Yeah, we're at Black Ambition Prize and I'm at Felicia Hatcher because it's easy for me to remember.
And if you ever need somebody, you know, any help in Paris, I know a couple guys.
Okay. Yes.
All right.
And we can't leave. We cannot leave without stating a huge shout out to our boy Neil Davis.
Yes. Neil.
He's been an ignorable part of this whole process of making sure that this episode happens. So shout out to my boy Neil.
Yeah. Shout out Neil. Thank you.
For sure.
And thank you guys as well for one, everything that y'all do. I'm a big Zone of Genius person. So kind of being able to walk into y'all genius and see so many entrepreneurs benefit from it has been something amazing to watch.
Yeah, you didn't tell them about your podcast.
So Ambitious Podcast.
Come on.
How could I forget about that?
Yeah, I got to check you out.
It's our storytelling. We're into season 2 with just some amazing entrepreneurs sharing some of their most ambitious moments of how they bet the house, how they've stepped out on faith, how they told the mustard seed to do the faith walk, all of that is the beautiful podcast that we've created. And Samia from our team has led that.
Insomnia?
Samia.
Oh, okay. About to say, that's an interesting name. All right, guys. Thank you for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.